Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Afterword. I'm Dave Tisch. I want to talk to you now about the worst film I've ever seen. Now that I think about it, I don't think it's the worst film I've ever seen. I think the worst film I've ever seen intentionally is the film Wild Wild West from 1999. Now, which is weird because the lead song, the single from that movie, Wild Wild West by Will Smith, and the accompanying video is one of the best songs of the 90s by far. Love that song. One of my favorite Will Smith songs. One of my favorite songs from the 90s, bar none. The video, so good. The song, so good. The movie, so bad. It's a Western. I remember watching this film on an airplane and feeling cheated as though I needed to get some money back for the time that I wasted watching this film. It's a Western, and I think that you've gone wrong as a filmmaker when your Western ends with a giant mechanical spider riding off into the sunset. It was anathema, one of the worst films I've ever watched in my life. No, that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about another movie that also came out in the late 90s in 1998, starring two giant megawatt stars. It was a romance movie, a romantic movie, a love story called City of Angels. And it starred Nicolas Cage, who had just come off an Oscar win for Best Actor in Leaving Las Vegas, and Meg Ryan, who was just coming off the tails of You've Got Mail, America's Sweetheart. And I'm not going to spoil anything, because if you haven't seen this film by now, it's like 25 years later. Fine. I'm going to spoil it. It's 25 years old. If you didn't want me to spoil it, should have gone to see it in the last 25 years. Anyway, the story is about an angel, Nicolas Cage. His character is an angel who watches over humans in untold ways. And he actually observes this medical doctor named Maggie, who's played by Meg Ryan, who works really hard to rescue people, but is in anguish when she can't. And he falls in love with her and then makes a deal to give up his divinity to become human so that he can fall in love and spend time with Maggie. He does. And in the process, they fall in love. And in the middle of this romantic bliss, Maggie is riding her bike and closes her eyes in just the ecstasy and joy of life and is hit by a logging truck. That's the plot. She dies. So he gave up his divinity for nothing. It was billed as a love story, as a romance movie, but that is a terrible date movie. That is just, everyone leaves the entire auditorium just feeling utterly depressed. It's just terrible. Still mad about that plot point today. You can't kill off Meg Ryan. She's America's sweetheart, okay? I'm still mad about that today. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is there was one redeeming aspect of this film, and that was the soundtrack. There was a song, that one of the lead songs from this film. It was called Iris by Goo Goo Dolls. And it was the main kind of love song. And that song became one of the biggest songs of the 90s and one of the deepest. And if you're familiar, you know the chorus. And it sounds like this. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they'd understand when everything's made to be broken. I just want you to know. And that sets us up perfectly for what we're going to talk about today. Shame. Hiding. See, the song, I don't want the world to see me because I don't think that they'd understand. We are desperately afraid of the world seeing who we really are, what we're actually going through, our brokenness, and then rejecting us. But then the second part of the stanza says, when everything's made to be broken, I mean, this is the reality of the world. Everything's broken. I just want you to know who I am. It speaks to the dual tensions that exist in every single human being. We're afraid if we're actually known for who we are, we'll be rejected. That is our greatest fear. And yet we know to our core that being loved and known for who we truly are and being loved anyway, that's healing. And that feels an awful lot like the love of God. And that's what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the story of Peter and his denial of Jesus. And that's the story. But it's actually a story about shame, about failing God, about what we do when that happens. And so I'm here with David Kim. We're going to talk and unpack that. We're going to talk about shame in this story, but we're not just going to talk about it from like a movie standpoint or from a culture standpoint. We're going to talk about how the story of Jesus, and Jesus in particular, destroys shame And that's what God's actually after. And that's a particular Christian response to the very real problem of human shame. Because at the end of it, it's not some people who have shame. There are some people who have shame and some that don't. All of us experience shame. So let's dive right in. Take it away, Goo Goo Dolls. All right, hey everybody, welcome to the Afterword. Oh, and do we have a treat for you. David and David, the two Davids, David Squared, here in the studio. I'm here with David Kim.
Here we go. Thanks for having me.
Man, now your shirt, no, the audience can't see this, but it says The Beloved. And basically, that's interesting because our name means beloved.
Mm.
We'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. And man, even as you say that, that's what I struggle with a lot.
What? Just being went 0 to 60.
Yeah, well, yeah. I just went there. Yeah.
Talk to me.
I know that in my head that I am beloved, but to really receive it and to live in it, to be settled in it is another conversation. And so I feel like even the name that I have, David, which I came up with in fifth grade, when I came to the States, I did it out of just like, oh, that's one of the easiest ways to pronounce a name. That's comfortable for me. But then little did I know that God actually was renaming or naming me, and that would be a journey for my own walk with God, where that's a difficult thing to receive from God. And I think God was actually trying to do something really beautiful in that. Wow.
And same as me. My name wasn't David either. That was given to me by my adopted parents. Ooh. So I was baby doe male on my birth certificate for, I guess, a couple months, 2.5 months.
Both of us, we've been renamed.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And we definitely don't struggle with identity and shame.
Not once.
Like that, right?
So. Not a little bit. So here's what we're talking about. We're talking about this moment in the Gospels where Peter is adamant. Jesus basically says, look, one of you is going to betray me. In fact, all of you are going to betray me. That's what he says. All of you are going to be scattered. And then Peter stands up in typical Peter fashion and says, look, if everybody here, all these yahoos fail you, I'm not going to. And Jesus turns to him, I think out of care and love, and says, actually, Peter, before the rooster crows three times at dawn, you're actually going to betray me three times. You're going to deny me three times. Mm. And he's like, nope, I'll die before that happens. And then, of course, the story goes on, and he does. So I think there's so much going on here. So before we get into like the effects on Peter, why do you think Matthew, with a lot of the gospel writers put this in, but why do you think Matthew focuses on Peter's denial and gives us a pretty long narrative about Peter's like failure of Jesus? Why do you think he goes there? Because after that in the story, Peter disappears from Matthew's gospel. He's not there anymore. So why do you think Matthew is putting this in?
Yeah, well, I can't get into his head, but I think all of the readers can relate to that story, that we all, even in our best versions of ourselves, even when we are in the spiritual high saying, Jesus, we will follow you for the rest of our lives, that we will be faithful to the end, even in our best versions of ourselves, we ourselves, if we're honest, that we struggle with our allegiance to Christ. And it is a mirror and a reminder for us that without Christ's grace and his strength and help, it is impossible for us to
be faithful, to keep our end of the bargain.
Yeah. I don't think we're lying when we say we want to serve you and love you. Right?
I don't think that Peter was lying.
Yeah, I think in his best version, he was saying, I want to do my best.
But he can't.
You can't without God's help.
Yeah. Right.
And so it is a reminder of human weakness and fragility.
Yeah.
Frailty.
Yeah, I love that. Also, there's Peter dramatically overestimates his own capacity to be faithful to Jesus, right? I think we do that too.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of self-lying maybe or not understanding of the reality.
Self-deception.
Yeah, self-deception, which is a core aspect of what sin is, right? Mm. It leads to self-deception. And yet I don't think he's lying. He's just weak, you know?
Yeah.
So then he does, he goes out and he betrays Jesus three times. Then the rooster crows and it says he went, I love this. The Matthew puts it, he went outside and wept bitterly. So there's a sense of isolation outside, you know, outside, all through the Bible, outside the walls, outside of Eden, outside is always mean, you know, you're alone. And then of course, cast off, and then he weeps bitterly. There's deep yeah. sorrow.
So this, shame.
Yeah, well, and that's where we got to shame. So I'd like to talk a little bit about this because, well, it's also interesting because Matthew just dropped Peter and then goes on. And I think what Matthew is trying to say, I look at Matthew, and I hope that I'm not reading into this too much of my own, but Matthew is very detail-oriented and very fastidious. Do you watch The Chosen? Have you seen that show?
A little bit, yep.
So it's actually really beautiful. They make Matthew a little on the spectrum, and because he's so fastidious and detail oriented, and I thought it was an interesting choice. Again, there's not any biblical record of this,
but that's what you're saying. Matthew is on the spectrum.
Well, no, I'm saying Matthew is really fastidious and detail oriented, and I think what he's trying to tell us by dropping Peter, showing us the scene. Is that even though Peter abjectly fails Jesus completely, Matthew is like, look, and then look what Jesus does. He still goes to the cross. He still dies. He's faithful even when everyone else, including the lead disciple, isn't.
Yeah. He never fails.
Yes. So I think in a perfectionist mindset, the problem with perfectionists and detail-oriented people is they think if they just try hard enough, they can actually hold everything together. And they just need to work harder. And I think Matthew might bear that burden as well. And what's going on there is he's saying, look, nobody can. So just let Jesus, because we're all going to fail him. And I think that there's something really beautiful in that. There's a meme my wife and I have been looking at and laughing at for the past couple of weeks. It says, there's two, one for her and one for me. It says, oh, you're a perfectionist? Tell me three things you're perfect at.
So good.
And another one says, oh, you're a people pleaser? Tell me three people who are pleased with you. And that hits both of us. So she crumbles in the middle of that, and I crumble too, because that's the whole joke is you can never be perfect enough. You're never perfect, and you never please people. No one's ever happy with you, right? So, and that's the joke. And I think that's part of what Matthew might be saying in this story, which I appreciate. But then later on, and you talk about this in your sermon a lot more, that there's other gospel writers that include more details. And so talk a little bit about like what you learned from, I guess, John's account, mostly John's account.
Yeah, well, I do mention Luke's account where Jesus says, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. And there's a spiritual reality to this conversation as well. But Jesus says, but don't worry, I've prayed for you. And once you return, go strengthen your brothers. And I remember that and reading that going, wow, like, yes, we want to own our own sin and brokenness. We don't want to blame or say it's somebody else's problem. But there's another spirituality that the scripture talks about where the enemy of God longs to come after us and find our weaknesses, find our blind spots, where we cannot even see where we need help, and use that against us to make us blind to our own brokenness and to be more overconfident. And in return, we disobey and we reject Jesus. And so just an invitation for us to be aware of that reality as well, that there's a spiritual element to our obedience to Christ.
Yeah.
And enemy wants none of that.
And I love but I prayed for you. And once you return, go and strengthen your brothers.
Jesus understands.
Yeah. So, and that gets to the shame part. Because I think when we fail Jesus, it's really hard. I love this. There's a famous book called Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. And in that book, whenever I would teach it in high school, there's this quote, and I would never teach this part, but it really stuck out to me. He's talking about the Bible. And Holden Caulfield, this unreliable narrator, this teenage boy, who he himself is a bundle of mess, says this, take the disciples, for instance. They annoy the hell out of me if you want to know the truth. They were all right after Jesus was dead and all, but while he was alive, they were about as much use to him as a hole in the head. And I love that. We love to crucify Peter and go after him because I think it's easier to call him a failure than to admit our own failures. It's easier for us to say, well, that guy, we do the same thing Peter did. Well, I wouldn't fail Jesus if I were in that situation. Yeah. This guy's broken. Ashley Cleveland, the musical, the Grammy award-winning Christian artist, who she wrote a book called Little Black Sheep. And she talks a little bit about this idea of brokenness and shame. And I wanted to share this and get your thoughts on it. She says, I assume that in coming to faith, my cracks and splits would be sewn together again in a seamless, saint-like fabric. But such is not the case. Much like the Velveteen Rabbit, I'm a series of threadbare patches, irregular stitches with the stuffing poking out, and one button eye displaced and downcast. I have serious issues with this. I have despised my brokenness and cry out to God regularly and petulantly, particularly after a public display of contempt or shame or greed or gluttony or grandiosity or insensitivity. I say to God, would it be such a big deal to relieve me of some of this? Could you make me just a little less broken? And the answer I perceive is always the same. No. More broken. And what she's trying to say is that we actually hide because we've been made to believe that our weaknesses and our failures, our mistakes, our sins, whatever it might be, are a source of shame. And those are things to be hidden in the Christian community so that we don't get rejected.
Yeah, but more and more that you own and hold your brokenness, you realize the magnitude of your belovedness. And so for me, our discipleship to Jesus is actually holding both our brokenness and belovedness well in our journey. Because more and more you realize how much grace you need and the depth of love that Christ has shown each and one of us, we have a greater sense and greater perspective on the extent of our belovedness. So I do think they go hand in hand.
Right. Well, if you think that your brokenness is something to be hidden, right, now we have real problems, right? Mm-hmm. And talk about why that's a problem for a relational community and for our spiritual lives.
Man, shame is such a massive, I mean, it starts from Genesis, right? That the first thing that humans did was once they rebelled against God, they were afraid and they hid from him. And this is what we do and we've been doing since the beginning of time. And I think it's destructive because shame is relational. Meaning when we hide, we're not just hiding our sins, we're hiding from God and one another.
Oh, man.
Which means that we are now alone, isolated, and we have nowhere to go, and it's all left to ourselves, and which enemy can then now use our isolation and loneliness as a tool in which to spiral us down to greater forms of worthlessness and despair.
Oh, my gosh, that's so good. It strikes me that if you put on a facade, and I used to teach high school, so high schoolers are great at this. And I think it probably starts in middle school. Middle school, you know, the old Catholic theologians are right. There is a place between heaven and hell where people go to pay for their sins. And I think it's middle school. It's just an awful wasteland of insecurity. And everyone's picking on everybody, and nobody, you know, everyone feels less than. Brené Brown, the researcher at the University of Houston, she has this wonderful quote for shame. She says, she's a shame researcher. Mm-hmm. So this is what she does. Shame is the intensely painful feeling that we are unworthy of love and belonging. And where else does that show up more strongly than in middle school, right? So what happens in middle school, you're still innocent, but then you get beaten so many times, what do you do? You're like, you put up masks. You have to.
Yeah.
You just have to start pretending to be someone you're not, or hiding who you really are, or putting on a strong face, or trying to blend in, you know? That's what it is.
I remember when I came to the States, I was fifth grade, I was in a class, and I had to pee. I was about 25 seconds away. But I did not know how to say, may I use the restroom? And so because of that, if I raised my hand and fumbled my English, broken English, I knew that the entire class would laugh. And so I just remember, due to shame, due to my classmates maybe laughing and making fun of my broken English, I bit my tongue and I suffered and struggled through. Do you know how hard that is, friends? That's probably one of my greatest accomplishments and the most shame-based movement.
How long did you hold it?
A good 45 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
And I was 25 seconds away from seeing the Lord.
Anyone who's ever been on a long car ride knows exactly what that's like. The pain of having to go to the restroom is so painful. Yeah. Yeah. So what happened? How'd that story end?
The story ended with me living into shame. And
did you eventually get to go to the restroom?
Once the bell rang and the bell saved my life. And
you turned into Usain Bolt.
Or I think if I remember correctly, I gently walked, because any kind of strong movement would release the floodgates. And so I did not bolt. I was cautious in every step. Oh, I think this is too much information.
No,
but
no, it raises the point, right? That this is what we do. I think everyone's felt that. And so that pain and the red hot shame that we feel makes us change our behavior. But the problem is, in middle school, when you start hiding, you get really good at it.
Oh, yeah.
And then you start editing yourself and what you're presenting, because you can't admit it, you know? And I want to talk real quickly, because I know your wife is a therapist. Nina is, she's got her degree in counseling and psychology. Am I saying that right? Is that the right word?
Yeah.
I know you're super interested in this, and it's almost like you audit her courses, that you would talk about how much you guys would share and talk. You're super interested in this. What's the primary activator for, because they shame researchers tell us it's a little different for boys than it is for girls, a little bit different for males than it is for females. What's the primary activator for males for shame? And what's the primary activator for females? I've heard Brené Brown say that the primary one in her research for men is weakness. That men, if they show weakness, that is their greatest source of shame.
Wow, that's interesting, because John Eldridge, who's also a psychologist, and he's been researching this for a long time, he said one of the core questions that boys ask in their developmental ages is, do I have what it takes? And it's connected to weakness.
Strength.
And weakness.
Will I be picked on the team?
Yeah.
Am I good enough in school? Right.
Do I have enough strength to survive in this world? And so
that's why athletic achievement for young boys is so important, to be really good at a sport, because then you can be, the question is answered.
Yep. And this is why it's also important that the father's voice to that young voice is so crucial in their formational developmental age, because once the father affirms and says, hey, yes, you can do this, that means so much to this young boy who is so insecure and confused about whether he can make this. And for a father to speak that over him is significant in their journey. And if you didn't get that, of course, and if you even got a good version of that, God, our Father's voice over us is so significant to heal or to receive that in our journey.
So, but let me ask you a clarifying question on that. The Father's voice to affirm that, you can do it. But sometimes that turns into the dad who's the coach, who's yelling at his kid, the father who's overbearing on the athletics.
Yeah.
Basically, like, I don't care if you don't have what it takes.
Yeah.
You're gonna be number one. And that can produce strong feelings of shame.
Yeah.
Too. So there's a dark side to that.
There's a dark side to that. And there's also a dark side to, if I keep hearing I can do this, I begin to also believe the lie that, wait a minute, that can turn into now a form of pride.
Yeah.
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 Or
arrogance or overestimation of your
own ability. I guess I don't need anyone else. Yeah. I can do this.
It feels like, and I think I heard this, that the job of parents, or fathers especially in the role of boys, is to say, look, you are flawed, and you've got things you're good at and things you're not good at, and that's okay. You are still beautifully and wonderfully made. God's got a plan for you, and we and God loves you, and I love you as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you might not be great at everything, and that doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it like when my kids were young. I talk about animals. like rhinos are big and strong, and actually they're pretty fast, but they're really, really, really terrible at being quiet. Or they're not good at swimming. Whereas like a dolphin's incredible at swimming, but no good at climbing trees. And a monkey's incredible at climbing trees and can like just jump, but it can't lift a huge box, you know? So depending on what animal you are, you could say each one has its, or eagle is incredible at flying and has incredible eyesight, but it's really bad in the water. So if you start measuring yourself by other animals, you're going to start to feel pretty broken. And instead of seeing all the beautiful ways that you are made specifically, and then what that might mean, that animal analogy really helped me as I was trying to explain to my kids why they're so different from their friends. Because if a fish looks at it and says, "Man, I can't climb trees like that monkey," they're going to feel bad about themselves their entire life.
Yeah,
you know, and that's the problem with our school system is that it only measures academic brilliance, and that's really kind of it. So every other kind of gift, there's no awards in school given for best friend, like really loyal friend, or incredibly creative musician. That's not an academic subject that's usually valued. Or do you know what I mean? Like really making it through pain and suffering, of having a hard life and not giving up and being resilient, that's not rewarded if you're a C student.
Yeah.
And you should be an F student. That stuff is never acknowledged, you know? Yeah. There's only one prom king and prom queen, and they're beautiful, you know? And that's it.
I mean, you're talking about now friendships and high school, and we don't have time for that. But yeah, even comparison itself is one of the ways in which you can help yourself to realize how God has designed and wired you, but also that comparison in the on the bad side of things could be a form of shame.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm not like my friends.
And I don't have the grades. And blah,
so
blah, blah.
Is it the same for females, or is it slightly different based on the stuff that you've read? Because I haven't done any research on the female side of it.
From what I've read, again, from psychologists who've studied this human development, especially in females, they say the fundamental question for them is, am I worthy? Am I worthy of love? And and so much on the conversations about
beauty, yeah,
and pursuit and love,
and
all of that. And so,
that seems ingrained in our culture. My daughter, she'll probably won't like me for saying this, but one of the things.
Sorry, Jail.
One of the things that is really hard is I think she's gorgeous. I think she's beautiful. But she's got wavy hair. It's thick, wavy hair. And there's not a day that goes by she doesn't hate her hair. She uses straightening products. She uses these chemicals. She uses straightening. She hates her hair. Hates it. Hates it. To the point where when we went to Texas and there was lots of humidity and her hair, which is already thick and dense and curly, frizzed up, she was like, "I am never moving here. Ever. I hate this state. I hate everything about it." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, that's fine." She's like, "I'm not going to school here." She's only going to live in arid environments, I think. But then her friends who have straight hair.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be fair, quite a few of her friends do. They have straight hair. She's envious of their hair. And they say, "Oh, what I would give for that kind of curl and body and bounce of your hair." So it's like, it doesn't matter. And I'm like, girls, stop. You're both pretty. You know, what are you talking about? This is absurd. This is like an emerald saying to the diamond, you know, "Oh, I wish I were clear." Like in the diamond saying, "Oh, you're so green and, you know, incandescent." It's just stupid, but it's ingrained, you know? So, so that's, and that's not something we taught her. We never said, my wife and I never for a second said anything about that, except that you're so pretty, you're so beautiful, we love you so much, totally. And all that kind of stuff. But it doesn't matter. It's just ingrained.
Yeah.
Okay, so getting free of shame, what's the antidote?
To come out of hiding, right? By nature of shame, again, Genesis 3, we hide. We hide from God and from one another. And so the invitation is to come out of hiding, and we call that word vulnerability. Right? And so we become vulnerable, more open, more honest with God and with one another. And in that very place, we begin to receive healing and strength.
Do you think that sometimes people actually try to hide from God in their prayers? Like they're afraid to be vulnerable and honest about what's actually going on in their lives with God. Mm-hmm. They think they have to clean themselves up to come before God. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that or experienced that?
Well, I've experienced it. Yeah. As my own, in earlier journeys of following Jesus, I wanted to make sure that God loved me and he cared for me. And so I got to, you know, like I got to kind of strain up, and like, obviously my theology was out of, you know, out of line with what the scripture teaches about who God is, but that's what I believe, that I had to come. And so much of that is because I live in a, I still do, I live, my culture, my Asian culture is a very shame honor based. And so I have to clean up, and image, image is a significant piece in a shame and honor culture. And so I have to look and dress certain way when I come to the public arenas. And so in prayer, in worship gatherings, in at retreats, like I try to do my best to kind of make myself a little bit better than I am.
Okay. And also your dad was a mega church pastor. And so that can add to the pressure. Preacher's kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. How did you untangle yourself from those expectations? Because it seems like it's pretty... I'm reminded of the joke. And this joke is told in a number of different ways. On the East Coast, it's told with a Jewish mom. On the West Coast, it's told with an Asian mom.
Mm.
So there's an...
Let's hear it.
Okay, so there's an adult woman, and she's there, and her adult son is swimming out in the ocean, and the current, the riptide, takes him. And she immediately sees that he's in trouble and goes to the, you know, just stands up and begins yelling, "Help, help, my son, Martin, the doctoral student at Harvard University is drowning." That's the joke. So the idea is that you are what you perform. You are what school you go to. You are what job you are. You are what career. There's only a couple that are valuable.
Mm-hmm. You are what others say you are.
You are what others say you are.
Yep.
And that's an, by the way, that works East Coast, West Coast. You've lived in an East Coast. You've lived on the West Coast. Yeah. You know that both are kind of similar. Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm more messed up.
You've lived in Boston as well. So there's a sense in which that those stereotypes are reveal something about the pressure to achieve in our world. And yeah, you can pick on, you know, those immigrant cultures or Jewish or Asian, but it's really the water.
It's different. It's
the water we all
Silicon
swim in.
Silicon Valley.
Yeah, Silicon Valley.
We're here to achieve and accumulate. Yep.
So how do you get free from that? Because I can imagine that a lot of people feel that.
Mm-hmm. And so a couple things in vulnerability. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is I think maybe I'll share my own journey of that. So I had to find someone safe, and I didn't know whether my church community was a safe place. Again, that was mainly because of my own dysfunctions, but still at the end of the day, I didn't know who to go to and how to have these conversations. And so I met with a therapist, and I'm not saying everybody should go. That's not what I'm saying. That was a safe place for me to begin learning the language of vulnerability. I didn't even know how to name my own stuff. I was an infant in vulnerability. And so he asked me, that's when he introduced me to Brené Brown for the first time. And I was reading her book and understanding it, and then coming to him with the entanglement, the complex terrains of my soul that I've been hiding for so long that I couldn't even find it anymore. And so learning that was really helpful, and that got into and his invitation to say, would you then now begin? The goal of therapy is not to see more therapists. The goal of therapy is to find enough language and tools for you to go back to the community. And so then he
encouraged kind of live in real life.
Yeah, and to find that in the church community.
So what was your next step after that?
Next step was I met with two other pastors and that I trusted and said, hey, like, I'm not ready to share this in my congregation. I'm not ready, but can you help? And they started opening up, and they went first, actually. That was a game changer. To experience the modeling of vulnerability was that really set me free from shame, because so much of it is like, do I have what it takes, and can I do this? What are other folks going to think about me? And so when they went first, that gave me the freedom and the grace and the opportunity for me to lean in as well. So that was a significant step.
I feel like they say that vulnerability begets vulnerability almost always, not all the time, but a lot of the time, because what it is it's saying, look, if you're going to expose and put yourself that vulnerable, like I know, now I know information that could absolutely destroy you. Mm-hmm. And if you shared that with me, then I guess I can begin to share some stuff with you too, because now I'm safe, right? Mm. Now, we shouldn't do this with everyone. You shouldn't do this at a staff meeting. Talk about wisdom and boundaries around vulnerability. Talk about that, because that's really important. Because if you share with the wrong person, it can backfire and then make you more prone to hide, right?
Yeah, so the question of how do you find a safe person, how you find a safe person is you share a little and you see how they react to it. And the way they react is the way you know whether they're trustworthy or not. So for example, I share something really small and they overreact or they start coaching you or condemning you or shaming you even more, then you realize, okay, this person cannot handle any of my stuff. And so to share, and if you do find someone and you share and it's met with kindness, compassion, grace, and understanding, then you're able to say, well, they have now begun to live in a trustworthy manner in our relationship. So let me now give a little bit more. And so that's how you begin. You don't dump everything from the beginning, but that's how you learn and grow in wisdom in that.
I also think it's interesting because it feels like that's what you're describing is just friendship. Mm. Like, and I think that, I think that's just friendship. You find, I can't explain how friendship works. It's just, and you talk about this in your book, Made to Belong. You talk about chemistry. It's almost like a supernatural thing. Not everyone is going to be your best friend. Not everyone has the same emotional depth, the same kind of way of seeing the world. Not everyone's trustworthy. And that's okay. Mm. Like, I don't think that I can be friends with every single human in Westgate Church, like deep friends. That's okay. But there's got to be somebody, you know, and that's, you know, it's, and then you find them. And then all of a sudden, and there's different levels of friendship. There's, you know, but there's, you know, I believe that God gives us soul friends that are for our benefit and for the sake of being known and being loved and, you know, going through that process. So that's what that is. So for you, it started with therapy, then moved out into friendship and then deeper and deeper friendship.
And they've modeled that first.
Yeah. And then you're able to, and then you begin healed.
Yeah.
It does feel like if there's any place in the world where this should happen, where people should be known for who they truly are, not rejected, but loved, it's here in the church. Mm. Like we've got all the resources. We've got God himself, right? Mm-hmm. Because like you said, if the world says you're terrible, you're not worthy of love, and if your parents say that, if your family of origin has said that, those are like if society and your parents say that, those are the two strongest voices in the world, except for one, the one above them all, the one who made you, the creator, the God of the universe, who says something very different. And that voice can begin to heal. And I think that we can actually be conduits of that voice. I think we can say that to one another, remind each other of that. And I think that that's what it means to be an image bearer. I think that's what it means to not take God's name in vain. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that that's part of what that means, is to remind each other what God has said about us. So
that's why I appreciate our teachers, our preachers, and our life group leaders who lead with that. They don't lead with perfection. They don't lead with stories of how great and awesome they are, but they share real stories of their struggles and pain. And I think as we continue to share honest stories in our community, I think that's how we continue to foster vulnerability and a place of healing, where obviously, of course, it comes from God, but to your point, through one another.
Man, well, I kind of think this could be a whole sermon series on shame. I mean, I think unpacking this and really delving into it is a really long process. And there's so much more to say that we haven't gotten to.
Yeah, like for example, if I were to ask you, what's the most shameful thing you've done? I want to know. what's one thing you're hiding in this season of your discipleship to Jesus? And
whoa,
yeah, it, it, those are those are strong questions, but I just feel like there's so much stuff that we can do together in our communities. And
yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to answer?
No. Now's not the time or the place,
yeah,
David.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, as you said, yeah.
But I got to have somebody I can talk that with and feel the safety and freedom. And also kind of like a confessional side, you know, confess your sins one to another so that you can be healed.
Healed.
That's the whole thing. There's got to be somebody to do that too. Well, Peter's story teaches us a whole bunch. The faithfulness of Christ, even though Peter fails him, Jesus still goes to the cross for him. Later on in John, he restores him very kindly and very tenderly and very specifically. Peter's failure does not surprise Jesus. Yeah. And his restoration is a form of strength for the rest of us. And so, yeah, it's a pretty beautiful story and one that we should reflect on. And thanks for being here. And you are beloved, David.
I am. You too.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye. Just want to say thanks to David Kim for stopping by. David, always awesome to talk with you. Join us next week when another Kim stops by. Jay Kim, we're going to be marching toward Easter, and we're going to be coming up to the part where Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then dies. We're going to be reflecting on that. So join us for that as we march toward Easter and Good Friday, and we'll see you next week.